So, a large part of spiritual practice is seeing which thoughts and ideas and worries, concerns, stories, dramas, fears bait the mind, snare the mind, and basically lift us out of present awareness and tranquility and focus, and lift us into these what are known as fantasy lokas. Lokas is the Buddha's word for worlds that primarily are mind worlds. Perhaps like things like trying to figure out how the future will play out, what's the worst possible outcome. There are actually a whole bunch of imponderables, the Buddha says, snare the mind and fill it with papancha, repetitive thought, until the entire awareness is just filled up with worry. Things like, what's going to happen to me in the future? It's unknowable. What really happened to me in the past? What was those past lives like? Now you can look at that literally in terms of if you believe in rebirth. I tend to view that more in terms of figuratively or as an analogy to trying to reconstruct all those parts of my childhood that have been blocked away by the ravages of time. Trying to reconstruct it all. Worrying about what people are doing when we're not around, what they're saying about us, unknowable. What people are thinking about us, trying to read their facial expressions, unknowable. A lure, a trap, something that sucks in the mind and gives it the promise that if we figure it out, what they're thinking about us, or what's going to happen to us in the future, or how much money we're going to have, or what somebody thinks about us, or what's going on between people, or whatever. The mind thinks, oh, if I can figure this stuff out, I'll have control, where there is no such thing as control. So those are one form of things that snare the mind into stress and suffering. And another, the Buddha used the example of the worldly winds. He says that we tend to look in the world for lasting safety and security and a feeling of being okay. And so we look for fame, or we look for money and financial gain, or we look for sensual pleasures that make us feel good really quickly. Sex or carbs or whatever. Or both at the same time. And then there's people-pleasing, getting approval. Those are the four worldly winds that push us in directions we like. But unfortunately, the moment you catch any of those winds, they can blow you in the wrong direction too. Fame can turn into obscurity or feeling ostracized. People approval can swiftly turn into disapproval from others. Things that feel pleasurable, we can get bored by, acclimatized to. We can build up tolerances. What once a couple of beers brought us now takes a bottle of whiskey to accomplish, and then two bottles of whiskey, or one hit from a crack pipe, now we need four hits every hour. That's the way of all sensual pleasures, and it's even the way when it comes to money. I read a fascinating clinical study where to get the same rush that a businessman gets from doing his first $1 million deal, the next deal has to be $5 million, and then the deal after that has to be $20 million to get the same sense of accomplishment. It builds exponentially. So So when we go out and we look for lasting peace, security, happiness, and I guess it requires making this hand gesture. Sometimes my hand gestures really are not helping. They're just looking kind of weird. But as we go out into the world looking for happiness, again, we get blown about and we wind up getting snagged and snared. So rather than simply telling ourselves over and over again, this isn't skillful, I'm thinking about something that can't be solved, I'm worrying about what people are thinking or how I compare to others or how or the unknowables, how much money I'm going to have in the future or what's going to happen to me, what kind of job will I have, you know, what kind of career or trying to get acceptance from people who are not giving it to me, trying to get approval from people who are not approving of me. Rather than intellectually knowing this, the practice is actually giving the mind a large enough, comfortable enough space so that these things that bait it, wondering what other people think is a bait, and I'm a fish, my awareness is a fish. Thinking about work, that's bait. And thinking about my mother, father, sister, brother, wife, husband, whatever, that's bait. And they're all dangling in front of you with their own little unknowables. And your poor little awareness is swimming around. Now, if you saw a fish in a little fish tank with somebody lowering a bait into it, you'd say that fish doesn't have much of a fucking chance. Because it's only a little bowl. After a while, he's going to run out of space to swim. And he's going to bite from that bait. And he's going to be, whatchamacallit, hooked. Yes, that was a senior moment for you in your 20s. The gesture was there, but the word just was not a... was nowhere to be found. Thankfully, I have those with properly functioning minds around to come to the rescue. So we get hooked. We get snared by these things. And so the work of Kayagata Sati, which means expanding body awareness, what it means is making the mind as spacious and as comfortable and as wide, if you will, so that there's room to be safe from all those things that generally bait us into obsessive thinking. Kayagata Sati is really a process of first filling the space that we're in. Totally filling. Are you totally aware of the space that you're in right now? Can you feel the entirety of your body? Can you feel the sensation of your legs hitting the cushion? Are you aware of it? Are you aware of the amount of space that your body is taking up? And can you fill it with your awareness? Can you first get in touch with the sensation? So much of our lives, we're wandering around in these, driven around, rushing around, trying to get to some place, and our body is racing behind us to keep up. And our awareness is a little bit ahead of the body. We're not even, we can't even really see it because we're so engulfed in the world and what other people are doing, or the monitor, Facebook. What is they saying now? Somebody commented. Somebody posted. Somebody posted on something I posted. Then I posted and then they posted again. Ever watch people? I mean, I'm like, too. It's like the mind is literally trying to get out of the body and onto the screen, you know? Fuck this body. I want to be in Facebook. But so anyway, we're not really very physically present, are we, when we're doing that? So, and so much of life, we're racing around. Get out of my way. You know, I'm trying to get somewhere. And so we're in this awareness that feels a little bit ahead of the body, and the body's trailing behind it, and we're really not... Anything that the body does is experienced sort of as a... as a, something that's getting in the way. You know, I got things to do. I got Facebook pages to merge with, and my body is telling me that I'm hungry. Or that, you know, that I'm uncomfortable, or that I have a headache, or whatever. That my body, if I experience it, most of the time it's telling me something that, oh, I have to attend to this thing again. So we have this arrangement with the body where once in a while we take care of it by exercising it, but most of the time we just want it to be there, and we're completely unaware of how the body is taking care of us 24/7, 365. When we're asleep, guess who's taking care of us? It's the body. That's what's keeping us alive. When we're completely aware of the computer screen and unaware of the body is still taking care of us. But what's going on when we get into these baited hooks of dramas is that the body becomes more and more aware that we are not with it, not present, not able to defend it or help. So it becomes more and more armored and more tight. And more constrained. And the more tight and constrained it becomes, the more our awareness stays away from it. Because we experience it now, the body, that thing beneath us, as tight because it's become armored and defensive. Because it's aware that we're completely in another world. We're in a Facebook world, or we're in a work world, or we're in a fantasy world, or wherever. We're completely unaware of the body. We've not done any work on relaxing it, breathing into it, making sure it's comfortable, tending to its needs, making sure that the posture is comfortable, making sure that it is okay. We've completely lost awareness of what it is to be in a human body. We've just become some sort of a... like one of those aliens with the big heads and the tiny little bodies. Welcome, Kirk. Yeah. We are all heads now. We have no need for the body. So, part of it is bringing full awareness to the space that we're inhabiting, noticing if the body is clear or if it's vague, if some areas are numb, if we can feel the breath moving through the body. This is the way we begin to get in touch. But then Kaya Dadasati involves more. What it really means is that most of the time we experience ourselves, ourself, as being somewhere right behind the eyes, and between the ears, right? Behind the eyes, between... That's where we think I exist. Now, I'm sure you know why that's the case. Because the dominant senses that monitor the world are the eyes and the ears. We're constantly attached to the sensations that are arriving through sight and through sound. So we locate ourselves... If I could drill a hole down here and... here, probably there'd be like a little person I envision like sitting behind the eyes and between the ears, and that's where we think we are. Interestingly enough, when people are through accident or through birth or are blind and deaf, and when they're asked through sign language to locate where the self is, where they envision it, they locate it much, much lower in the chest. Because they don't have this sense of they're completely pinning all of their awareness to the senses that are externally based, the eyes and the ears, sound and sight. We are often so deprioritizing senses, especially the tactile senses and the senses of the somatosensory senses of awareness of the body. We so deprioritize them that we experience it after a while in life, we experience the body as something down there, like a cellar. It's not even the house anymore. It's the cellar. And when we go into the body, you know, it's like, uh-oh, I'm going into the cellar with the flashlight. God knows what I'm going to find in there. Something, there's going to be a bad sensation. I know it, some kind of monster. I don't like this idea at all. Can't we go back to being up in the head? And we go down the stairs into the body, and it's scary. Because again, we view the body as just being the place where those pesky sexual needs arise, and hunger, and the occasional bellyache and gas, and shit, and piss. When you think about it that way. But this is the thing that's keeping us alive, and actually through practice, it's really essential that we can lower the awareness into the body. Ajahn Susita refers to it as finding that arbitrary edge where we say, oh, this is where my mind ends and this is where body sensations begin, and begin to efface, to wipe away that false distinction between I'm up here and the body is down here. And this is what we're doing in meditation. We're not doing it simply because it's a cool, freaky kind of altered states, William Hurt movie with acid, and wow, I'm going to try to lower my awareness into the body because that sounds like some cool experiment, and maybe after that I'll be able to levitate and float out of the room. That's not why we're doing it. The more that we have entire embodied awareness, A, the more we can relax the gut feelings that we're unaware of that are always going on beneath our awareness and are making us do things often that are against our best interest. We have these things called gut feelings, or if you're a psychiatrist, psychologist, you know it as a somatic marker. It's basically the unconscious saying, oh, this situation in the past sucked. I didn't like it. Therefore, I'm going to make my stomach really tight, or my chest really tight, or my throat really tight. I'm going to do what I can to create an uncomfortable environment so that I'll get the fuck out of here. It's a way that the unconscious mind, the amygdala and the hippocampus, speak to us. They don't speak to us directly. They don't have language. They're not that smart. They're in the reptilian part of the brain, as it used to be called. It's not really a reptile brain, but these parts of the brain don't speak. They simply have bad associations with things. And when we get exposed to something that in the past was scary, like somebody who reminds us of our dad when he was angry, someone who reminds us of a teacher we didn't like, something that reminds us of a bad situation when we were mugged or experienced violence, the moment we see any sensation that's similar, an expression, the unconscious triggers the body to get tight. This is called feelings, gut feelings. A lot of times gut feelings are useful. They're very helpful when it comes to work. If you work as somebody that has to make a lot of decisions. If you need to make a decision really quickly, arguing it back and forth logically is not very useful. If you're at a job and, for instance, you're, you're an art director. I should know about that. Say you're an art director and you're designing something. You're not figuring out intellectually why something should go there and something should go there. Ooh, should it go there or should it go there? You're simply trusting your gut because you've done it a million times, and now the way that you're the striatum and the unconscious is telling you what it prefers to do is by listening to your body. When people lose awareness of the body via the, I think it's the ventromedial going through a lesion or through a tumor being removed, they can no longer make decisions because it's body awareness that allows us to make decisions where the mind would normally ping-pong back and forth between two arguing lawyers in our heads. So it does play a role, but then there's a lot of times in life where feelings, gut feelings, lead us in the wrong direction. A lot of times. For instance, suppose you go outside one day and you experience something scary and you rush back indoors. A lot of people wind up, just from simple experiences, becoming complete shut-ins because they've experienced one or two discomforts out in the world. Or perhaps early in life they're in an elevator and the elevator stalls. And then they get fear. Physical discomfort arises when they're in an elevator and they begin to avoid going in elevators. Avoidance is less powered by thought than it is by gut feelings. Some great studies on this by Joseph Ledoux and Antonio Damasio. Gut feelings push us around, not only choosing what kind of foods we eat. When somebody asks you what you want for dinner, you don't ponder it out and figure out the protein breakdowns in a hamburger versus a pizza. You just go with what your gut tells you. Sometimes your gut will keep on pushing you towards a milkshake, even though that's not, or a donut. Might not be in your best interest. Your gut might push you away from getting on an airplane or in an elevator or talking to someone you find intimidating. Always allowing our gut sensations to be churning away in the background without our awareness, because we have no body awareness, allows us to be pushed around by our unconscious, to be pushed around and fall into bad habits. The way to break out of bad habits is first to see this level of gut stress, contraction that arises in the chest, the throat, the brow, the belly, wherever, the shoulders. To find where we are contracting, breathing into it, and making the body as comfortable as we can, keeping the breath as comfortable as we can. And that's the way we actually can walk through things that we used to find terrifying, by making the body as comfortable a place as it can be. So there's a lot of good reasons to make the body, fill the body with our awareness, lower the, or it's at least expand the awareness into the body. But the most important is so that we can get some space and some distance away from those thoughts that are repeating themselves over and over in our mind, trying to get our attention and snare us again and again into fear and into worry and into trying to figure out everything. The more spacious the mind is, the larger it is, the more distance it can have from the thinking, the worries, the concerns, the dreads, and the more it can stand outside them and say, you know what? That thought is really repeating itself over and over and over again. And would I listen to somebody who's following me around nagging me all the time, saying, hey, 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 you, you, no, no, you, you, yeah, you, but I already listened to you. No, 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 no. We don't have money for the rent. I listened to that already. I heard that, but I, no, no, no. Listen, we're screwed this time. Really, really screwed. But I paid, I always figure out how to pay. Not, this time we're screwed. Now, if you're right up next to this person in a small elevator, good fucking luck. You have not listened to that. But if the awareness is the size of a mansion, and they're at one corner, and you're at another space down in the body, there's enormous potential to say, yeah, I know that guy over there. He's screaming at me. But I think I'm going to look over here. I think maybe I'm going to tidy up this corner of the mansion or the house. So making the body as spacious, filling it up with breath, and making it as comfortable a place, because you don't want to lower your awareness into something that's tight and contracted and miserable. You want to lower the awareness into a body that feels like a cushion, like a warm couch to receive it. So this takes a lot of time. It requires a lot of patience, a lot of practice. At first it can feel very awkward in meditation, especially lowering or expanding the awareness into the body, because we're so used to being up here. But actually, once it becomes something that we can do, it becomes very much a core part of developing peace within, allowing the mind to become enlarged and spacious and kayagata sati. Finally, I'll conclude with, there's a lot of times in life when the storms of following the worldly winds, seeking approval, seeking money, seeking careers, seeking fame, seeking this and that, where real storms blow up, where you get really bad news at work, where people in our jobs really don't like what we're saying, really aren't approving, when we get broken up with, or when something that we've been working on, a project, goes horribly awry. And in these times when hurricanes blow up and you need to go into some place that's safe, the safest place is the body. It's like sailing a ship into a port and waiting out the storm. And part of the process is just saying, yes, right now things suck. Yes, they do. There's a temptation as a spiritual practitioner saying, well, I should be grateful. I know I'm about to... I fucked up things at work, and everybody is not, happy with what I'm doing there. But I'm grateful that I have a human birth. And while that's true, and it's useful, and it's helpful, really, the real practice of staying safe is not allowing the awareness and the attention to always drift out of the body and to cling entirely and shrink around the dramas. It's about keeping part of the awareness balanced within so that it has room enough to focus on things that are safe rather than venturing out and trying to eat the food out there in the world when the winds are blowing really hard and everybody's upset and the stock market's crashing and the job is shitty and the relationships are tough or whatever. We eat what we have inside. Not literally, we don't eat ourselves, but I mean we become capable of sustaining peace within. Therefore, we become less reactive to what people say, less reactive to what's going on around us, more at peace. So that was my talk on kayagata sati, expanding into body awareness, one of my favorite teachings by the Buddha. And again, I thank Zach and Chris and for all of you who came last week. And now it's your turn to ask any questions or share anything that you like on any topic.